And yet you claim to be civilized, whatever that means. The man was obviously shaken, and not a little impressed by my outburst. I heard him pacing the room. Forward, a scrape of feet as he turned around. Backwards and then forwards again. Suddenly he stopped beside me and said, "I will consult my superior." Rapidly he moved away and obviously picked up some hard object. It went whir, and then hrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr Speech, I judged. The man with me spoke at length, making the same sort of peculiar sounds. Clearly there was a discussion which went on for some few minutes. Click, clang, came from the machine, and the man came back to me. First I am going to show you this room, he said. I am going to tell you about us, what we are, what we are doing, and I am going to attempt to enlist your aid by understanding. First, here is sight. Light came to me, sight came to me. A most peculiar sight too. I was looking up at the underside of the man's chin, looking up his nostrils. The sight of the hairs in the nostrils amused me greatly for some reason, and I began to laugh. He bent down and one of his eyes filled the whole of my vision. Oh! He exclaimed, someone has tipped up the box. The world whirled about me, my stomach churned and I felt nausea and vertigo. Oh! Sorry, said the man, I should have switched off before rotating the box. Never mind, you will feel better in a moment or so. These things happen. Now I could see myself. A horrid experience it was to see my body lying so pale and wan and with so many tubes and attachments coming from it. It was a shock indeed to see myself and see that my eyelids were tight closed. I was lying on what appeared to be a thin sheet of metal supported on just one pillar. Attached to the pillar foot were a number of pedals, while standing by me was a rod which held glass bottles filled with colored fluids. These were in some way connected to me. The man said, you are upon an operating table. With these pedals, he touched them, we can put you in any desired position. He stepped on one and the table swung around. He touched another and the table tilted until I feared that I might fall. Another, and the table rose until I could see right under it. A most uncanny experience which caused the strangest sensations in my stomach. The walls obviously were of metal of a most pleasant green color. Never before had I seen such fine material, smooth, without blemish, and clearly some special form of joining must have been employed, for there was no sign even of where walls, floor and ceiling ended or commenced. The walls flowed, as one might say, into the floor or into the ceiling. No sharp corners, not a single sharp edge. Then a section of the wall slid aside with that metallic rumble I had come to know. A strange head poked through, looked around briefly and as abruptly withdrew. The wall slid shut. On the wall in front of me there was an array of little windows, some of them about the size of a large man's palm. Behind them pointers stood at certain red or black marks. Some larger rectangular windows attracted my interest. An almost mystical blue glow emanated from them. Strange spots of light jiggled and danced in some incomprehensible pattern, while at yet another window a brown-red line wavered up and down in strangely rhythmical forms, almost like the dance of a serpent, I thought. The man, I will call him my captor, smiled at my interest. All these instruments indicate you, he said, and here are indicated 9 waves from your brain. 9 separate sine waves with the output from your brain electricity superimposed upon them. They show you are of superior mentality. They show you have truly remarkable ability to memorize, hence your suitability for this task. Very gently turning the sight box, he pointed to some strange glassware which previously had been beyond my range of vision. These, he explained, continually feed you through your veins and drain off waste from your blood. These others drain off other waste products from your body. We are now in the process of improving your general health so that you will be fit enough to withstand the undeniable shock of all that we are going to show you. Shock there will be, because no matter that you consider yourself to be an educated priest, compared to us you are the lowest and most ignorant savage, and what to us is commonplace, to you it will be miracles beyond belief almost, and a first introduction to our science causes severe psychic shock. Yet this must be risked, and there is a risk although we make every effort to minimize it. He laughed, and said, in your temple services you make much ado about the sounds of the body, oh yes. I know all about your services, but have you really heard body sounds? Listen. Turning, he moved to the wall and pressed a shining white knob. Immediately from a lot of small holes came sounds which I recognized as the body sounds. Smiling, he twisted another knob, and the sounds increased and filled the whole room. Throb, throb, went the heart sounds in such volume that the glassware behind me rattled in sympathy. A touch of the knob again, and the heart sounds went, and there came the gurgle of fluids in the body, but as loud as a mountain stream rushing across a stony bed in its anxiety to get to the sea so very far away. There came the sigh of gases like a storm rushing through leaves and branches of mighty trees. Plops and splashes as though great boulders were being toppled into some deep, deep lake. Your body, he said. Your body sounds. We know everything about your body. But, unhonored captor, I said, this is no marvel, this is no miracle. We poor ignorant savages here in Tibet can do as well as that. We too can magnify sound, not so vastly, agreed, but we can still do it. We can also release the soul from the body, and bring it back. Can you? He looked at me with a quizzical expression on his face, and said, you do not scare easily, eh? You think of us as enemies, as captors, eh? Sir. I replied, you have shown me no friendship yet, you have shown me no reason why I should trust you or cooperate with you. You keep me a paralyzed captive as some wasps keep their captives. There are those among you who appear to me to be devils, we have pictures of such and we revile them as nightmare creatures from some hellish world. Yet here they are consorts of yours, appearances can be misleading, he replied. Some of these are the kindest of people. Others, with saintly mien, would stoop to any low act that occurred to their perverted minds. Yet you, like all savage people, are led astray by the outward appearances of a person. Sir, was my response, I have yet to decide upon which side your interests lie, good or evil. If they be good, and I be convinced, then and then only will I cooperate. Otherwise I will use any means I can to circumvent your aims, no matter the cost to me. But surely, was his somewhat cross rejoinder, you will agree that we saved your life when you were starving and ill. I put on my gloomiest expression as I answered, saved my life, for what? I was on my way to the heavenly fields, you dragged me back. Nothing you can do now will be so unkind. What is life to a blind man? How can one who is blind study? Food, how shall I get food now? No. There was no kindness in prolonging my life, you even stated before that I am not here for my pleasure but for your purpose. Where is the kindness in that? You have me trussed up here and I have been the sport of your females. Good? And where is all this good you mention? He stood looking at me, hands on his hips. Yes, he said at last. From your point we have not been kind, have we? Perhaps I can convince you, though, and then you will be useful indeed. He turned and walked to the wall. This time I saw what he did. He stood facing a square filled with small holes and then pushed a black dot. A light shone above the whole square and grew into a luminous mist. There, to my stupefaction, a face and head formed in living colors. My captor spoke at length in that strange, outlandish tongue and then stopped. To my petrified amazement, the head swiveled in my direction, and bushy eyebrows were raised. Then a small grim smile appeared at the corners of the mouth. There was a barked terse sentence, and the light faded. The mist swirled and seemed to be sucked into the wall. My captor turned to me with every sign of satisfaction on his face. Right, my friend, he said, You have proved that you are a strong character, a very tough man with whom to deal. Now I have permission to show you that which no other member of your world has seen." He turned to the wall again and stabbed the black spot. The mist formed again, with this time the head of a young female. My captor spoke to her, obviously giving orders. She nodded her head, stared curiously in my direction, and faded away. "Now we will have to wait a few moments," said my captor. "I am having a special device brought in, and I am going to show you places on your world. Cities of the world. Have you any choice where you would like to see?" "I have no knowledge of the world," I replied. "I have not traveled." "Yes, but surely you have heard of some city," he expostulated. "Well, yes," was my answer, "I have heard of Kalimpong."
"Kalimpong, eh? A small Indian border settlement. Can't you think of some better place? How about Berlin, London, Paris, or Cairo? Surely you want to see something better than Kalimpong?"
"But, sir," I replied, "I have no interest in those places you mentioned. The names convey nothing to me except that I have heard traders discuss such places, but it means nothing to me, nor am I interested. Nor if I saw pictures of these places could I say if it were true or not. If this wonderful contraption of yours can do what you say it can do, then show me Lhasa. Show me Thari. Show me the Western Gate, the Cathedral, the Potala. I know those and will be aware if your device is true or some clever trick." He looked at me with a most peculiar expression on his face. He appeared to be in a state of stupefaction. Then he pulled himself together with a visible jerk and exclaimed, "Taught my business by an unlettered savage, eh? And the fellow is right too. There is something in this native cunning after all. Of course he has to have a frame of reference, otherwise he will be not at all impressed. Well. Well." The sliding panel was abruptly jerked aside and four men appeared guiding a very large box which seemed to be floating on air. The box must have been of considerable weight because although it appeared to float without weight it took much effort to start it moving, or to change its direction, or to stop it. Gradually the box was edged into the room where I lay. For a time I was fearful that they were going to upset my table as they pushed and pulled. One man bumped into the eye box and the resulting gyrations left me for a time sick and dizzy. But at last, after much discussion, the box was placed against a wall directly in line with my sight. Three of the men withdrew and shut the panel behind them. The fourth man and my captor engaged in animated discussion with much waving of hands and gesticulations. At last my captor turned to me and said, "He says that we cannot bring in Lhasa because it is too close. We have to be further away so that we can focus." I said nothing, took no notice at all. And after a short wait my captor said, "Would you like to see Berlin? Bombay? Calcutta?" My reply was, "No, I would not, they are too far away for me." He turned back to the other man and a quite acrimonious argument followed. The other man looked as if he wanted to weep, he waved his hands in utter frustration and in desperation dropped to his knees in front of the box. The front slid off and I saw what appeared to be just a large window, and nothing more. Then the man took some bits of metal from his clothing and crawled to the back of the strange box. Strange lights shone in the window, swirls of meaningless colors formed. The picture wavered, flowed, and deadened. There was an instant when shadows formed which might have been the Potala, but again, it might equally have been smoke. The man crawled out from the rear of the bog, mumbled something, and hurried from the room. My captor, looking very displeased, said, "We are so close to Lhasa that we cannot focus. It is like trying to see through a telescope when one is closer than that instrument will focus. It works well at a distance, but close up no telescope will focus. We have the same trouble here. Is that clear to you?"
"Sir," I replied, "you talk of things I do not understand. What is this telescope you mention? I have never seen one. You say that Lhasa is too close.
I say it is a very long walk for a very long time. How can it be too close?
An agonized expression shone on my captor's face. He clutched his hair and for a moment I thought he would dance on the floor. Then he calmed himself with an effort and said, "When you had your eyes, did you ever bring something so that your eyes could not focus?" "That is what I mean. We cannot focus at this short range." Chapter 4. I looked at him, or at least felt as though I looked at him, because it is a most difficult experience that a man can undergo to have his head in one place and his sight many feet away, coming from a distant place. Anyway, I looked at him and I thought, what marvel can this be? The man says that he can show me cities on the other side of the world, yet he cannot show me my own country. So I said to him, "Sir, will you put something in front of the sight box so that I may judge of this matter of focus for myself?" He nodded his head in instant agreement, and cast round for a moment as though wondering what to do. Then he took from the bottom of my table a translucent sheet of something upon which there were very strange markings, markings such as I had never seen before. Obviously it was meant to be writing, but he turned over what appeared to be a few sheets and then he came to something which apparently satisfied him immensely because he gave a pleased smile. He held the thing behind his back as he approached my sight box. "Well now, my friend," he exclaimed, "let us see what we can do to convince you." He slid something in front of my sight box. Very close it was, and to my astonishment all I could see were blurs, nothing was clear. There was a difference, part was a white blur, part was a black blur, but it meant nothing to me, nothing at all. He smiled at my expression. I could not see him smile, but I could hear him smile. When one is blind, one has different senses. I could hear his face and muscles creak, and as he had smiled often before, I knew that those creaks meant that he was smiling now. "Ah," he said, "getting home to you at last, am I? Now, watch carefully. Tell me when you can see what this is." Very slowly he pulled the obscuring sheet backwards. Gradually it came clear to me, and I saw with considerable astonishment that it was a picture of me. I do not profess to know how this picture was produced, but it actually showed me lying on the table looking at the men who were carrying in the black box. My jaw dropped open in profound amazement. I must have looked like a real country yokel. Certainly I felt one. I felt the heat rising and my cheeks were burning with embarrassment. There I was, done up with all those things sticking out of me. There I was watching the four men maneuver that box, and the look of astonishment on my face in the picture really did get home to me. "All right," said my captor, "obviously you get the point. To drive it home, let us go through it again." Slowly he held the picture so that I could see it, and moved it closer to the eye box. Slowly it got unclear until I could see a whitish-blackish blur, and nothing more. He whipped it away and then I could see the rest of the room again. He stood back a few paces and said, "You cannot read this, of course, but look. Here are printed words. You can see them clearly?" "I can see them clearly, sir," I responded. "I can see them very clearly indeed." So then he brought the thing closer to my eye box and again there was that blurring of vision. "Now," he said, "you will appreciate our problem. We have a machine or device, call it what you will, which is a very much greater counterpart of this eye box we are using on you, but the principle would be utterly beyond you. It is such, however, that we can with it see all around this world, but we cannot see anything which is 50 miles away. 50 miles away is too close, just the same as when I brought this a few inches from your eye box you could not see it. I will show you Kalimpong." With that he turned aside and did something to some knobs which were upon the wall. The lights in the room dimmed. They were not extinguished, but they dimmed so that the light was akin to that which follows immediately the setting of the sun beyond the Himalayas. A cool dimness where the moon has not yet risen, and where the sun has not yet withdrawn all its light. He turned to the back of the big box and his hands moved over something that I could not see. Immediately lights glowed in the box. Quite slowly scenery formed. The high peaks of the Himalayas, and upon a trail a caravan of traders. They crossed a little wooden bridge beneath which a rushing torrent threatened to engulf them should they but slip. They reached the other side and they followed a trail through rough pasture land. For some minutes we watched them, and the view was that which a bird would obtain, a view as though one of the gods of the sky were holding the eye box and gently floating across the still barren terrain. My captor moved his hands again and there was an absolute blur of motion. Something came into sight and went by. My captor moved his hands in the opposite direction. The picture steadied, but, no, it was not a picture, it was the actual thing. This was not a picture, this was reality, this was truth. This was looking down through a hole in the sky. Below I saw the houses of Kalimpong, I saw the streets thronged with traders, I saw lamaseries with yellow-robed lamas and red-robed monks wandering about. It was all very strange. I had some difficulty in locating places because I had been to Kalimpong only once, and that was when a young boy, and I had seen Kalimpong from foot level, from the level of a small boy standing. Now I was seeing it, well, I suppose I was seeing it from the air as the birds see it. My captor was watching me intently. He moved certain things and the image or landscape, or whatever one is to call such a marvelous thing, blurred into speed and steadied again. "Here," said the man, "is the Ganges which, as you know, is the sacred river of India." I knew a lot about the Ganges. Sometimes traders from India would bring magazines with pictures in them. We could not read a single word of writing in those magazines but the pictures, ah. That was different. Here before me, unmistakably, was the actual river Ganges. Then to my quite stupefied surprise it dawned on me that I was hearing as well as seeing. I could hear the Hindus chanting, and then I saw why. They had a body laid out on a terrace by the water's edge and they were sprinkling the body with the holy water of the river Ganges before conveying it to the burning ghats. The river was crowded, it seemed absolutely amazing that there could be so many people in the world, let alone in a river. Females were disrobing in a most shameless manner on the banks, but so were the men. I felt myself going hot all over at such a display. But then I thought of their temples, the terraced temples, the grottos, and the colonnades, and I looked and I was amazed. This was reality indeed, and I began to be confused. My captor, for I must still remember, he was my captor, then, moved something and there was a blur of motion. He peered into that window intently, and then the blurring stopped with quite a jerk. "Berlin," he said. "Well, I knew Berlin was a city somewhere in the Western world. But all this was so strange that really it didn't convey much to me. I looked down and thought that perhaps it was the novel viewpoint which was distorting everything. Here there were tall buildings, remarkably uniform in size and shape. I had never seen so much glass in my life, there were glass windows everywhere. And then on what seemed to be a very hard roadway there were two metal rods set into the road itself. They were shiny and they were absolutely uniform in their distance apart. I just could not understand it. Around a corner and into my range of vision walked two horses, one behind the other, and, I hardly expect you to believe this, but they were drawing what appeared to be a metal box on wheels. The horses walked between the metal bars and the wheels of the metal box actually rode along those bars. The box had windows, windows all the way around, and peering in I could see people, people inside the box, people being drawn along. Right in front of my sight, I almost said right in front of my eyes, so accustomed was I now to this sight box, the device drew to a halt. People got out of the box and others got in. A man went to the front, in front of the first horse, and poked about in the ground with another rod. Then he got back into the metal box and drove off, and the box then turned to the left, off the main set of rods onto another. I was so amazed at this that I couldn't look at anything else, I had no time for anything else. Just this strange metal box on wheels carrying people. But then I looked at the sides of the road where there were people. Men were there in remarkably tight clothing. They had garments on their legs which seemed very, very narrow, and outlined the exact contours of the legs. And on the head of each man there appeared the most remarkable bowl-shaped thing, upside down, and with a narrow rim around it. It caused me some amusement because they did look peculiar, but then I looked at the females. I had never seen anything like it. Some of these females were almost uncovered at the top of their body, but the lower part of the body was absolutely wrapped in what seemed to be a black tent. They seemed to have no legs. One could not even see their feet. With one hand they clutched the side of this black tent thing, apparently in an effort to keep the bottom from dragging in the dust. I looked some more, I looked at the buildings, and some of those buildings were truly noble edifices. Down the street, a very wide street, came a body of men. They heard music coming from the first lot of men. There was much shiny, and I wondered if it was gold and silver instruments they had. But as they came nearer I saw that the instruments were of brass and some were just metal. These were all big men with red faces, and they were all dressed in some martial uniform. I burst out laughing at the strutting way in which they were walking. They were bringing their knees right up so the upper limb was quite horizontal. My captor smiled at me and said, "Yes. It's a very strange march indeed, but that is the German goose step which the German army use on ceremonial occasions." My captor moved his hands again, once more there was this blurring, once more the things behind the window of the box dissolved into forming mist, then stopped and solidified. "Russia," said my captor, "the land of the Tsars. Moscow." I looked, and snow was upon the land. Here, too. They had strange vehicles, vehicles such as I had never imagined. There was a horse harnessed to what appeared to be a large platform, fitted with seats. That large platform was raised several inches from the ground by things which looked like flat metal strips. The horse drew this contraption along, and as it moved it left depressions in the snow. Everyone was wearing fur and their breath was coming like frozen steam from their mouths and nostrils. They looked quite blue with the cold. But I looked about at some of the buildings, thinking how different they were from the ones I had seen before. They were strange, they were great walls standing up, and beyond the walls rooftops were bulbous, almost like onions upside down with their roots projecting up into the sky. "The palace of the Tsar," said my captor. A glint of water caught my sight, and I thought of our own happy river which I had not seen for so long. "That is the Moscow River," said my captor. "It is a very important river indeed. Upon it there rode strange vessels made of wood and with great sails hanging from poles. There was little wind about so the sails were hanging flaccid, and men had other poles with flattened ends which they moved so that the flat ends dipped in the river, and so propelled the craft. But all this, well, I did not see the point of it, so I said to the man, 'Sir, I have seen undoubted marvels, no doubt it would interest many, but what is the point of it? What are you trying to prove to me?' A sudden thought occurred to me. Something had been nagging at the back of my mind for the last several hours, something which now leapt into my consciousness with insistent clarity. 'Sir, captor,' I exclaimed. 'Who are you? Are you God?' He looked at me rather pensively as if he were nonplussed by what was obviously an unexpected question. He fingered his chin, ruffled his hair, and shrugged his shoulders slightly. Then he replied, "You would not understand. There are some things which cannot be comprehended unless one has reached a certain stage. Let me answer you by asking you a question. If you were in a lamasery and one of your duties was to look after a herd of yaks, would you answer a yak who asked you what you were?" I thought about it, and then I said, "Well, sir, certainly I should not expect a yak to ask me such a question, but if he did ask me such a question I should regard it as proof that he was an intelligent yak, and I should go to some trouble to try to explain to him what I was. You asked me, sir, what I would do about a yak who asked me a question. And I reply to you that I would answer that yak to the best of my ability.
In the conditions which you mention, I would say that I was a monk and that I had been appointed to look after those yaks, and that I was doing my best for those yaks, and I regarded them as my brothers and my sisters, although we were in different forms.